Chapter 45. Nobility of Character. Whatever envy, hatred, revenge, the most remorseless motives that govern mortal mind, whatever these try to do, shall, quote, work together for good to them that love God, end quote. Mary Baker Eddy, 1907. Counsel for Next Friends did not dismiss the suit graciously. The next morning, August 22nd, their statement to the press included, "Taking a larger view of the matter and considering its bearing upon Mrs. Eddy's alleged religion, which I have long conceived to be utterly nonsensical, where it is not distinctly harmful, it is to be regretted that circumstances did not permit of a full hearing and determination upon the merits. Speaking for myself, I shall never cease to regret that so-called Christian Science could not, by judicial decree, have been shown to be the creation of a discordant mind." Little wonder that the revelator to this age put a very dark picture of herself in the, quote, little book, end quote. Next Friends Council also endeavored to imply in the press that they had not asked for dismissal, but that there had been compromise. The editor of the Concord Patriot, Michael Meehan, was very perturbed by this insinuation of a compromise and wrote, quote, "If a doubt still lingers, let it be dispelled by the positive statement of the author, and he knows, quote, there was no compromise," end quote. The following letter, which came from New York City, was written August 24th. "My dear Mrs. Eddy, upon my return to the city, I found the autographed copy of the new edition of Science and Health, containing the new picture, for which I thank you. I shall prize it greatly because of the inscription. I am well pleased with the quality of the reproduction. Again, thanking you, and with best wishes, I am cordially yours, B. Frank Puffer." Beneath the new picture in Science and Health, above the facsimile of Mrs. Eddy's signature, are the words, quote, "Copyright, 1907, by B. Frank Puffer, New York," end quote. Augusta Stetson had probably acted as liaison between Mr. Puffer and Mrs. Eddy, and she too was the recipient of a copy of the new edition right after the lawsuit collapsed. Her letter of August 25th to the leader included, quote, "I have just opened another new edition of Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. I cannot express my exceeding great joy as I beheld within its covers your dear face," end quote. Mrs. Eddy greatly enjoyed conversation with a real thinker, and Adelaide Still recalled a visit she had with her astute cousin, probably after dismissal of the lawsuit. Henry M. Baker was not a scientist, and according to Miss Still, Mrs. Eddy asked him some questions about matter and mind, which he had to admit that he could not answer. Then she said something which made him laugh and kept him good-humored, so that when he left, he was smiling and happy, and evidently felt that he had had a good time with her. After he had left the room, however, Mrs. Eddy looked up at me with a smile on her face and said, quote, "I have given Henry a dose of truth that he will not get rid of for a long time," end quote. But Henry Baker's visit on August 25th was of a different nature. he brought with him to Pleasant View W.T. McIntyre of the New York American, though he was doubtful as to whether Mrs. Eddy would or should grant an interview, which, however, she did. Persecution cannot last forever. There is always a reaction. But I hold no enmity. Those who have attempted to injure me have gained nothing. Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy uttered this sentiment of Christian forbearance to me today in the first interview she has granted since the collapse of the suit brought by her next friends. No one who has talked with Mrs. Eddy can doubt her deep spiritual nature. No one who has met her can fail to be profoundly impressed by her nobility of character. The leader proved that she held no enmity by writing to her adopted son a few days later, addressing him as Benny, as she had fondly called him in happier days. In her letter, she said she would, quote, be pleased to see your dear face once more for a chat with you after the old way, end quote. But Foster Eddy's sense of guilt kept him from accepting this invitation. On the day that Mr. McIntyre was at Pleasant View, Dr. Hamilton, another real thinker, was back home in New York, giving an interview about Mrs. Eddy to the New York Times, in which he stated, "The sensational stories which have been disseminated about her have no foundation in fact, although they can be very easily traced to a spirit of religious persecution that has at last quite overreached itself." An interesting postscript to Dr. Hamilton's month in Concord and investigation and examination of Mrs. Eddy is this letter the leader wrote to Alan Hamilton. "I am in receipt of your kind letter, and it would give me great pleasure to comply with your request that I sit for a photograph, were it not for the fact that latterly I have failed to obtain a satisfying picture of myself, and have so given up the effort. The solution of this failure may lie in this, that Christian Science depicts the real man or woman spiritually and not materially. Hence the difficulty for me to obtain a photograph of that which is not real. Understanding as you do human nature, you may see the consistency of the above explanation of the failure to depict that which we deny as the actual and eternal." The progress gained by the dismissal of the lawsuit was somewhat overshadowed by the desertion of the leader by the students, who felt that the crisis was past, and who were eager to return to their own worldly interests and endeavors. The business committee gave Calvin Hill some names of new prospects for help at Pleasant View, and he wrote Mrs. Eddy on August 27th that he would start investigating them the next day. She wrote on the back of this letter, "Darling, I thank you. Please wait till I get breath over Mr. Wilson leaving me. I have now to watch and to qualify a new secretary. The persecution of your leader is far from being over." Mrs. Eddy wanted a secretary who would remain with her for the next 3 years. Irving C. Tomlinson had been a member of her last class in 1898, following which she had had him move to Concord. For the past 9 years, she had worked closely with Mr. Tomlinson. He had often been to Pleasant View and had done some secretarial work for her for short periods. Now that his sister was no longer with him, he was eager to become a permanent member of Mrs. Eddy's household. but Mrs. Eddy knew Irving far better than he knew himself. She also knew that the animal magnetism that had so hypnotized his dear sister would not overlook Irving as he became more useful to the leader. Many a student had been blinded to her Christliness and thus turned away from the truth. Malicious mind endeavored to destroy those who could not be blinded nor turned aside, which was so evident in Mary Tomlinson's case. Such occurrences caused the leader to tell her students, "I have told you that evil has no power, yet I have told you to handle evil as though it had power. This is because of your place in growth spiritual. When the allness of God is seen, the nothingness of evil is evident. Hold to that." Handling evil impersonally for another, or knowing theoretically that it has no power, is but the first step. Standing under fire is the test. The leader saw that Mr. Tomlinson needed something more to fortify him and to strengthen his resistance to the attacks of malicious animal magnetism. Before he moved to Pleasant View as her secretary, she had Mr. Streeter draw up a contract which bound him in the minutest details. This agreement stated exactly what she would furnish him and what Mr. Tomlinson was expected to furnish her in return. Should he lose his desire to stay and serve the leader, he was bound to remain with her until the contract was fulfilled. But a new secretary was only one of the items demanding the leader's attention. The issue that was foremost in her thought was leaving New Hampshire. Much as she loved her native state, in New Hampshire, her personal appearance in court could be compelled, which she had been informed was not the case in Massachusetts. She needed a larger house than Pleasant View for her ever-enlarging household, but she did not want anything pretentious, and she wrote to Alfred Farlow, quote, "I want a window in my room like the one here. It relieves my lonely hours," end quote. Above all, she wanted absolute secrecy on the move until it was an accomplished fact, so only the few directly concerned knew anything about it. One of those concerned few was Calvin C. Hill, whose commission was to have exact duplicates made of the furniture in her sitting room and bedroom, the only difference being that the reproductions were to be mahogany in place of oak. On September 10th, after she had greeted the metaphysical workers gathered in her room for the morning lesson, she opened her Bible, as was her custom, and read Romans 15. "But now, having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you, whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you, for I trust to see you in my journey." Mr. Tomlinson recorded in his diary that day, "She said in substance that she could not tell us the import of the words, that they were in perfect harmony with what she had been dwelling upon the entire morning. I asked what was meant by Spain, and she only smiled." She may have been thinking of moving in, quote, "sacred secrecy," end quote, when she wrote in her notebook on September 17th, 1907, quote, "Let my church buy the house and rent it to me," end quote. Or she may have been thinking of not owning property, that could be attached by lawsuits, or perhaps it was both. In the Sentinel for September 21st, the advertisement for Science and Health included, quote, "This edition contains a fine photogravure portrait of Mrs. Eddy, together with a facsimile of her signature," end quote. This advertisement mentioning her portrait continued every week as long as Mrs. Eddy was here with us. When later editions of the textbook included textual changes, this sentence in the advertisement for Science and Health was changed to read, quote, "This work contains important changes and additions by the author. Also, a photogravure portrait of Mrs. Eddy, together with a facsimile of her signature," end quote. September 30th was the date set for final dismissal of the Next Friend suit in Judge Chamberlain's courtroom. The master's report was read and accepted, and then Mr. Chandler made extended remarks and, quote, "in a negative way left the impression that he expected the suit to continue," end quote, stating that Mr. Streeter had objected to dismissal. Mr. Streeter arose and said that he had no objection to granting Mr. Chandler's request for dismissal, but Chandler asked for delay. Judge Chamberlain, this is a motion to dismiss, is it not? Mr. Chandler, yes. Judge Chamberlain, what necessity is there for argument? Nonetheless, Chandler continued to argue a number of points, one being that Mrs. Eddy should pay all costs of the suit. Mr. Streeter left this determination with the court, stating, quote, "The master's fees have to be paid, but I object to an order compelling Mrs. Eddy to pay them, while I would not object to an order against Mrs. Eddy's trustees under the trust deed of March 6th for the purpose of bringing them in as parties to the proceeding," end quote. Before this issue was settled, Chandler sought to submit a brief of his objections to the rulings of the masters. Finally, Judge Chamberlain held, 1. That the brief could not be filed. 2. That the motion of Next Friends to dismiss the bill be granted. 3. That the report of the masters be affirmed. 4. That the trustees under the deed of trust be allowed to come in and be heard on the question of costs. 5. That Next Friends have until October 10th to file a brief on the question of costs. 6. That counsel for trustees have until October 15th to reply. 7. That arguments on the question of costs be submitted on October 15th. The point Mrs. Eddy had sought to establish in the first place was at last acknowledged, that issues involving her property should be handled by her trustees. After Chandler had first filed for dismissal on August 21st, the leader's heart had overflowed with forgiveness to all those who had opposed her. She had written forgiving letters to Next Friends, and she had even mentioned inviting Mr. Chandler to visit her at Pleasant View. However, right after this court session on September 30th, Mr. Streeter wrote to her, "I think I thoroughly know W.E. Chandler. I have carefully observed his attitude of mind with reference to yourself personally and this case. The objection to your plan is that he strongly disbelieves in you and in your system of healing and in your religion. He has convinced himself that the claims of yourself and your followers are arrant humbuggery. The differences between you and Chandler are fundamental. His only purpose in going to your house would be to get some advantage over you. He would not meet you with the same spirit with which you would receive him. The one thing Mr. Streeter did not know about Mr. Chandler, which Mrs. Eddy understood so well, was that he was the tool of animal magnetism. But Mr. Streeter was probably right in his assessment that Chandler would merely use the visit as an opportunity to gain some advantage against Mrs. Eddy, even as had Mr. Slott. In the Sentinel for October 12th was an announcement that the time had arrived for the erection of a suitable building to house the Christian Science Publishing Society, and inviting contributions for this purpose. Earlier in 1907, Mrs. Eddy had purchased the house next door to her Commonwealth Avenue house. By October 12th, a suitable residence had not been decided upon, and Mrs. Eddy was considering occupying her two houses. In a letter to Mr. McClellan on that day, she said, "Buy all that is needed on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, so that my carriage may come to my door and be shielded from two near neighbors. I shall need a stall for two horses. There is needed also a door into my house, now occupied by Mr. Armstrong, and one of the large rooms should be made into two rooms. There must be 9 sleeping rooms for my household. What I shall need, if I can have it, is in addition to my house, also a stable in the rear, with rooms for my driver and his family. Elevators would add to convenience." Commonwealth Avenue had been built up considerably, plus becoming an artery for traffic, since Mrs. Eddy had been there. So this plan was not practical. Mr. McClellan acted upon her further statement, which was, "I would, however, like to purchase the right place in Brookline. It may be possible that you can purchase of the madam in Newton. Do it if you can, but have her make no mention about it." The 25-room house on Beacon Street in Newton, on approximately 12 acres of land, partly wooded, could better accommodate Mrs. Eddy's large household. So Mr. McClellan arranged the purchase. The stone carriage house and stable were already there, but extensive alterations to the house, plus decorating, were necessary before it would be ready for Mrs. Eddy. In October, the estate was purchased by Robert P. Walker, a wealthy Chicago real estate dealer and well-known Christian Scientist. The extensive remodeling was begun with orders for the greatest possible speed. Mrs. Eddy wrote in her notebook, quote, "My home on Beacon Street, Brookline, cost $207,061.36, end quote. The question came up at this time as to the advisability of sponsoring lectures in areas where there was no Christian Science activity. Mrs. Eddy answered this question for all time, although indirectly through her editor in the Sentinel of October 12th. "The lecturers are doing a magnificent work in their line of endeavor, but this work would be practically useless as a means of enhancing the growth of Christian Science were it not for the, quote, signs following, end quote. The true basis of the establishment of Christian Science in any community must be the healing of the sick, and the deliverance of the sinful. And this must precede every other form of work or organization. To heal the sick is the eternal mandate of divine love, and Christian Science churches cannot be established and maintained on any other basis. On October 15th, the leader had Irving Tomlinson write to the trustees, "Because of important duties here and after consultation with our beloved leader, she has suggested that I ask you to find a substitute to act for me while I am temporarily absent from the meetings of the Bible Lesson Committee." John Lathrop was called to Pleasant View once again for a few months of service, either to assist or to replace Mr. Tomlinson. Irving Tomlinson loved both Christian Science and Mrs. Eddy dearly, and endeavored to devote himself to her service. All newcomers to Pleasant View were startled by the severe rebukes to shock him, quote, "out of a mesmeric influence," end quote. And few, if any, understood such treatment in the slightest degree. Those who did not profit from this stern treatment by becoming chastened, receptive, and teachable, and thus going up higher, were soon sent away. Tomlinson was not a newcomer, but perhaps the leader had not rebuked him severely in the past. When she did, on more than one occasion, he reacted to the rebukes, and more than once he was sent away. October 19th was one day that Mr. Tomlinson reacted to the chastening rod. Mr. Fry did not say whether he was dismissed at that time, but he did record in his diary the next day, quote, "Last evening, under the influence of malicious animal magnetism, Mr. Tomlinson told Mrs. Eddy she was ungrateful and a tyrant," end quote. The leader did not express gratitude or much appreciation when things were done for her in a human way, that is, by mortal mind. But her gratitude was lavish whenever a student turned to God in his efforts to help her. Often the leader was very patient with the slowness and dullness of her disciples, although she did say, quote, "I feel like telling my students to hurry up," end quote. There was not one speck of animosity in her rebukes. They were wholly from mind, and she was only the spokesman. Adelaide Still recorded, "Occasionally, when smarting under a mortal mind sense of resentment, after some such rebuke, I have gone into her room in answer to her call, and found that she had completely forgotten the circumstances, and she would look at me in astonishment and say, 'What are you crying for, Adelaide?'" There were few students who could not profit from severe rebukes and thus grow spiritward. In fact, there may have been only one humble enough to escape this chastening treatment, the conscientious John Salcho. But even John learned the intended lesson by witnessing the rebukes of others. Laura Sargent was severely reprimanded one day when John was working in Mrs. Eddy's study, and when Laura was called to the study again, she was in tears. John recorded the leader's surprise and gentle words, quote, "Why, Laura, I was not speaking to you. I was speaking to the error. You should not take it to yourself," end quote. The leader so longed for students whose only desire was to progress spiritually. She knew they could make half a century of progress in 1 year in her home, which a great many did. Half a century was nowhere near enough but none seemed to want the continued discipline demanded by spiritual advancement. She had sensed that Miss Still truly had this desire when she had said to her, quote, "I have been asking God to send me the right one, and I believe that He has," end quote. But there were times when mortal mind tempted Adelaide to leave, and sensing this too, Mrs. Eddy would say, quote, "You won't leave me, will you, Adelaide? You will stay with me as long as I am here?" End quote. Miss Still said, "At such times, one would feel such a sense of love in her thought that all sense of hurt or resentment was wiped out, and I would say, 'Yes, Mother dear, I will stay with you as long as you need me.'" Mrs. Eddy did not need Adelaide as much as Adelaide needed the leader. But Mrs. Eddy was far more aware of this than was Miss Still. The leader also knew what Adelaide did not, that she had but 3 short years for the divinity course in her home. Before the end of 1907, Mrs. Eddy amended the bylaw in the manual, quote, "Opportunity for serving the leader," end quote, which had required 12 consecutive months of service. It now read, quote, "It shall be the duty of the member thus notified to remain with Mrs. Eddy 3 years consecutively," end quote. Obviously, she felt there would be a greater blessing for mankind from one individual with 3 years of the divinity course than from 3 individuals with 1 year each. Some said she was getting old and didn't like change, which was their own human opinion. All of the Revelator's decisions were God-directed. One of the letters Mr. Tomlinson had written for Mrs. Eddy recently was to Dr. Hamilton in New York, who responded on October 25th. "My dear Mrs. Eddy, I received the most interesting history of the Congregational Church at Concord, read it, and hastened to return it, as Mr. Tomlinson requested. It reflects, as Mr. Tomlinson says, the kindly feeling towards you in your community. In my opinion, it does more, for it is the admission of respect of one church for another, and the recognition of your own sincerity and purity of your life. With the hope that when I next go to Concord, I may have the pleasure of seeing you, and with congratulations upon your continued good health. I am sincerely your friend, Alan McLean Hamilton." On October 15th, the final hearing regarding costs for the next friend's suit was postponed by mutual consent till November 12th. But this was not Chandler's final action against Mrs. Eddy. On October 25th, he began further negotiations, supposedly on behalf of George Glover, to get a portion of Mrs. Eddy's million-dollar estate. Most people thought the litigation was ended on August 21st, when the next friends had filed to dismiss the suit. The official end was on November 12th, when the court ordered 1. That by consent, the trustees pay the master's fees, but as an offset to this, said trustees have a judgment against next friends for $3,000. 2. The defendants in this suit have judgment against next friends for their costs. 3. The regular court costs are taxed up against next friends. There was one person who was not finished with this suit. Michael Meehan had followed every aspect of this persecution of Mrs. Eddy since it first began, with the invasion of Concord by hostile and aggressive reporters more than a year earlier. On more than one occasion, the unmanly lies had aroused righteous indignation in him, and he had decided to write the truth of the whole story in a book. The masters and attorneys had all gone over the complete transcript of the hearing, and, quote, each made such alterations therein as conformed to the requirements of good usage and the elucidation of his thought, and eliminated therefrom ambiguous and redundant expressions, end quote. Mr. Meehan felt that Mrs. Eddy should have the same privilege. Her appreciative handwritten response to Mr. Meehan so pleased him that he published it in facsimile in his book. November 16, 1907. Mr. M. Meehan, beloved student, I am glad to have had opportunity to read and revise my interview with the masters for your book, The History of the Court Trial. I fancy I have not exceeded my privilege. I have added nothing, have not changed the thought, but have erased some unnecessary statements and repetitions in both the questions and answers. Also, I have corrected some errors in rhetoric and grammar that must have resulted from inability on the part of the stenographer to distinctly hear what was said. Affectionately and gratefully, Mary Baker G. Eddy. Sue Harper Mims, who was in Concord to deliver a lecture at the Concord Church, was invited to visit the leader at Pleasant View. Mrs. Mims wrote before leaving Concord, "Beloved leader, words cannot thank you sufficiently for the joy and uplifting from my visit to you, beloved of the Lord. I see the cordon of angelic hosts that encircles Pleasant View, and nothing evil can pierce those walls of salvation, nor come nigh thy dwelling. The lecture was a success. A choice and most attentive audience greeted me, and I felt that the truth was received. It will interest you to know that General and Mrs. Streeter were there, and that after the lecture, they both came to congratulate me and to say how much they enjoyed the lecture. I had met Mrs. Streeter in Atlanta at a luncheon given by my daughter, and she said she had often thought of me and my work in Christian Science, that she would love to entertain me were I remaining longer, and many other pleasant things. In greeting General Streeter, I said, quote, you know, dear General Streeter, we all love you for your magnificent defense of our beloved Mrs. Eddy, end quote. And Mr. Herring said, he seemed much pleased and touched. The lecture, however, seems but an incident. The cherished event is my short but glorious visit with you, beloved one, God's anointed chosen one, whom he ever guards and protects. I am enjoying a visit with my dear friends, your devoted, loving, and loyal students, Mr. and Mrs. Herring. With fondest love, your devoted student, Sue Mims.